This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In 1970, a pregnant Colette McDonald and her two young daughters were brutally murdered at their Fort Bragg, North Carolina home. The sole survivor of the attack was Colette's husband, Jeffrey. He said four people who appeared to be high on drugs broke into the house, slashed him, and murdered his family. Jeffrey McDonald was a Green Beret doctor at the time. He was arrested and tried in a military court that found him not guilty. But he was subsequently convicted in a civilian court and has spent the last 33 years in prison. His story and the crime have been written about extensively, most famously in a book called Fatal Vision by author Joe McGinnis. McGinnis worked closely with Jeffrey McDonald to tell his story, and Fatal Vision brought the case national attention. However, it concluded that Jeffrey McDonald was indeed the murderer. As damaging as Fatal Vision was to Jeffrey McDonald's case, his story never faded from the minds of many. Filmmaker Errol Morris has been haunted by it for more than 20 years. He has reinvestigated the case and written a book called A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald, and it gives a compelling new support for the convicted man's version of the events. Errol Morris is my guest on the program this hour as we talk about his new book. Welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me on.
So how did you first learn of the McDonald murders? Now, was it Fatal Vision, or had you been following it in the papers before then?
The Thin Blue Line was finished at the end of the 80s. And perhaps because I had been so intimately involved with a miscarriage of justice in Texas, I became aware of this case. I remember reading Fatal Vision, seeing the TV movie, ultimately reading Janet Malcolm's book about the civil litigation McDonald sued McGinnis. It's a case that's been on my mind probably from the early 90s on. But there was an untold story here, and I felt it was very important for someone to tell it.
Well, you know, we should back up a little bit for those who are not familiar with what happened that night of February 17th, 1970 at the McDonald home at Fort Bragg. Tell us about the crime itself.
Two versions, McDonald's version and the prosecution's version. Jeffrey McDonald went to Princeton, Northwestern Medical School, was a Green Beret captain in the Army stationed at Fort Bragg outside of Fayetteville, North Carolina. 26 years old, married to his high school sweetheart, two lovely daughters, his wife pregnant with their third child, their son. According to McDonald, four intruders broke into the house, attacked him, slaughtered his family. According to the police, McDonald did it. Now, here is one of the oddities of this story, a story that just simply will not go away, 42 years out.
Well, it's interesting, too, that the first trial was really a court-martial. The MPs, of course, were the first to investigate, and by all accounts, they really botched the crime scene. They were not very experienced in how to manage a crime scene like this.
Fingerprints lost, evidence destroyed, a rush to judgment where they felt they had their man, and so they stopped looking for any kind of evidence that would suggest otherwise. And the central piece of evidence that would suggest otherwise was this hippie girl, Helena Stokely. And part of what I have tried to do in A Wilderness of Error in my book is to bring Helena Stokely back to life. The woman in the floppy hat who claimed that she was in the house that night, present during these murders, and essentially telling us that McDonald was telling the truth.
His story, this story of four people high on drugs, a woman with long blonde hair, boots, and a floppy hat. Just a year before the Charles Manson murders, of course, were committed, the murder spree
not
in California.
Not just a year. We're talking a couple of months. The Manson family members were arrested in December of 1969. And these crimes occurred early in February of 1970.
And, of course, it sounded suspicious. I mean, here is Jeffrey McDonald pretty much laying out the same scene. And, in fact, Esquire magazine had just done a long article about it, that edition of the magazine.
Well, not just Esquire. The story of Charlie Manson and his family and the Tate and LaBianca murders in Los Angeles, they were everywhere.
Of course, what made it suspicious was the Esquire magazine version was in his house at the time, and it just led investigators at the time to think, well, yeah, he's read all about it. Everybody has. It's been all over the place. And he's just taken the details of that, superimposed it on a crime that, according to investigators, he committed. So we're not going to believe his story. But you find that Helena, the woman in the floppy hat, in fact, an investigator had seen her, a police officer, or one of the investigators had, in fact, seen her very close to the crime scene that night.
Well, we don't know exactly who he saw. We know that one of the early responders, an MP, Ken Micah, on his way to the crime scene, saw a woman standing in the rain and fog not far from the McDonald house. He didn't stop. He couldn't pick her up. He was answering a 911 call. Coincidence that she seemingly answered to the description that McDonald gave to Ken Micah when he arrived at that house that night. And then another coincidence, seeming coincidence. A narcotics cop in Fayetteville, Prince Edward Beasley, had an informant, Helena Stokely. And when he heard the description of this woman on the radio early that day following the murders, he said to himself, I know that woman. That's Helena Stokely. And he went looking for her. And he didn't find her right away, but when he found her, she started saying suggestive things. Suggested in the sense that she was suggesting she might have been in the house that night. And very shortly afterwards, she started saying she had been there. And ultimately, she told that story to over a dozen people.
What happened to that story, and why didn't it make its way into the courtroom where McDonald was finally convicted?
Well, here's my theory. Because if the jury had heard that testimony, they would never have convicted McDonald. The prosecutors did everything they possibly could, and the judge did everything he possibly could to prevent that testimony appearing in front of the jury.
Of course, the blonde hair that he had seen was, if it had been Helena, she wore a wig, and in fact, there was evidence of that kind of hair, a couple of strands of blonde hair from a wig, that were found at the crime scene. It didn't seem to match much else.
That's correct. Here's where I get agitated. You can say all of these were just coincidences, that Helena Stokely was one of those people who just likes to confess to murder, that the person on the roadway could have been anybody, that there really is nothing more than a set of odd coincidences in all of this. My question is, when do coincidences become more than just coincidences? When do they become evidence? When do we start to think that they provide evidence of an alternative version of what happened that night? On the stand in Raleigh in 1979, 9 years after the murders, Jeffrey was finally tried and convicted of 3 counts of murder, sentenced to 3 consecutive life sentences. Those witnesses that Stokely confessed to were not allowed to appear before the jury. And Helena Stokely, when she took the stand, even though she had told people just the day before that she had been in the house, suddenly couldn't remember anything. Her mind went blank. And the question has been, what's that about? Why couldn't she remember something that she clearly remembered the day before? And 25 years later, a federal marshal, Jimmy Britt, came forward in Raleigh and said, I was there when Stokely was interviewed by the prosecutor, James Blackburn, and Blackburn threatened her. Blackburn told her, you either change your story or I'm going to indict you for first-degree murder.
And she was already a police informant, meaning, but because she had been on the street, somebody who had been using drugs and that sort of thing, she was pretty vulnerable to begin with, I would assume.
Vulnerable to begin with, but that's a big no-no.
Right.
You don't threaten a witness. Right. You don't try to get a witness to change her story. And people today say, why do I believe Jimmy Britt and why do I believe that Blackburn is lying when he says that this never happened? And I have a number of very simple explanations. Let's see if I can convince you. There was never any good explanation for why Stokely suddenly went blank on the stand. Jimmy Britt provides us with an explanation of why that happened. Why shouldn't I believe James Blackburn? Because of the entire complexion of this prosecution, where they were constantly jiggering the trial, changing the evidence, suppressing material, and because of Blackburn's subsequent history, where he was convicted of embezzlement, fraud, and became a proven pathological liar.
This is The State of Things. My guest, Errol Morris, a filmmaker and author of the new book, A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald. We will continue our conversation on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest this hour, Academy Award-winning filmmaker Errol Morris, who for the last two decades has been independently investigating the 1970 murders of Colette McDonald and her two young daughters. Errol is also the author of the new book, A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald, and it questions the trial and conviction of Jeffrey McDonald. So, you know, one of the interesting things to me in all of this is the fact that the court-martial initially did find, was not able to convict Jeffrey McDonald. He comes back. He left North Carolina. He was discharged, in fact, honorably discharged from the Army. He goes to work as an ER physician out in California. And then he appears on the Dick Cavett Show, and that changed everything.
My next guest is Dr. Jeffrey McDonald.
On December 15th, 1970, McDonald appeared on the popular late-night program, The Dick Cavett Show.
I hope this isn't too painful for you.
Where it became very clear McDonald was fast becoming his own worst enemy.
My wife came home and we had a before-bedtime drink, really, and watched the beginning of a late-night talk show.
He knew how to do it, as we say in the talk show trade. He knew how to handle himself.
Dick Cavett remembers well the night he was face-to-face with McDonald.
His affect is wrong, totally wrong. My affect was, to find your wife and kids murdered. And even his answer to that was something like, hey, yeah, isn't that something? Almost sound like Bob Hope. Very like Bob Hope.
There were people in the Army who wanted a court-martial, regardless of any evidence.
Where are these investigators now who did the original?
Well, most of them have been transferred. It's the Army way of handling things. If someone really fouls up, you either give them a medal or you transfer them.
Uh-huh. So now that's a little bit from the CBS documentary program, CBS 48 Hours on CBS. But the point is that, as Dick Cavett pointed out, it didn't seem like he had just lost his family. And I wonder, and that, of course, was the thing that triggered the civilian trial. Is that right?
Not exactly right, but McDonald was often his own worst enemy. I've often wondered about that passage that you just played. I've heard it many, 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 many times. Dick Cavett tells us that his affect was just fine. He's a talk show host. And that McDonald's affect was all wrong. McDonald was very angry. This is after the court-martial, and after he learned that the investigation was going to go on. the Criminal Investigation Division of the Army, was not fated by the decision of the military court. Colonel Rock had dismissed charges against him, saying they were, quote-unquote, not true, and yet they had decided they were going to go after him no matter what. It became a vendetta, and McDonald was well aware of that vendetta. Part of that show is his anger at the military authorities for not going after Stokely, for not going after the people who he believed had been responsible for the deaths of his family. I think it has been grossly taken out of context, misinterpreted, and to me, it says very, very, very little. It tells me more about Dick Cavett than it tells me about Jeffrey McDonald.
You have to wonder what on earth an appearance on a talk show, short of a confession, I mean, your affect, how does that, trigger a new trial? I mean, I don't understand how that even happened. Somebody watched you on Dick Cavett and said, oh, he's not sorry enough, let's go after him?
People have asked me, did you spend a lot of time with McDonald? How many times did you interview him? And the answer is I did not interview him that many times. There's one interview that appears in A Wilderness of Error. To me, the issue is not how he comports himself on television. You know, the issue is not whether I like Jeffrey McDonald or not. I do like Jeffrey McDonald. He's articulate. He's intelligent. And I believe him. But that's not the issue. The issue is evidence. And should that evidence have been put before the jury in 1979? That's the issue.
But it was clearly important to some people, and it was important to, as I understand the story, and you can tell me if this is accurate, but Colette's father, the victim's father, Jeffrey McDonald's wife, his father-in-law, at first agreed with Jeffrey McDonald. He did not think his son-in-law was guilty, but something about that appearance and perhaps other factors led him to change his mind.
Jeffrey, once again, did a whole number of things to antagonize his in-laws. Perhaps principal among them, the fact that he moved to California and started a new life. Why this became a crazy vendetta? Many reasons. I don't believe that any of the authorities, and I don't believe this is true of the in-laws, that they chose to frame an innocent man. They believed he was guilty. They convinced themselves he was guilty, and as a result, they acted accordingly. They acted aggressively. They acted persistently to try to bring him to justice, and I just don't buy into it, again, for many reasons. I believe they conducted the investigation in such a way where they didn't even bother to look for evidence that could have been exculpatory. They didn't really pursue the claim that Stokely could have been responsible. They were interested in Stokely, to be sure, but they were interested in Stokely only to the extent that they could show that she wasn't telling the truth, or that she was deluded, or that she was drug-crazed, or that she was unreliable. It was never pursued with the idea, hey, this could be true.
Helena Stokely, of course, has since passed away. There is a story that she told her mother on her deathbed that she did it and made a confession yet again.
I flew down to Raleigh very late in the game, and I interviewed Helena Stokely's younger brother. And to me, it's one of the powerful and most moving interviews in this entire book, A Wilderness of Error. Yes, she's dead. She's a major figure in this case, and I wanted her to come to life in a way that we could see her not as some football to be tossed around by the lawyers and prosecutors, but as a person, what her motivations might be, who she was, why we should seriously entertain a belief that she was telling the truth.
we know that you are pretty convinced that she was telling the truth. It's interesting to think about the way this case was framed. If we think about most wrongful convictions, especially the most notorious, it's basically police and prosecutors going after the most likely-looking suspect, the one that the general public is most likely to believe, and it's just easier for them. In this case, it does seem to be the reverse. We have a clean-cut, green beret physician versus, you know, a drug user and a police informant. Why was she not the easy prey for police and prosecutors?
I'm not altogether sure. When you go to a crime scene, and this was true of the criminal investigation that was at the heart of The Thin Blue Line, this movie that I made that freed a man who had been sentenced to death for a crime he didn't commit. We love narratives. We love stories. You see a crime scene and you want to provide some kind of an explanation. And for whatever reason, the early responders, the CID, came to the conclusion not just that there had been no intruders, but that McDonald had rigged that crime scene to make it look as though there had been intruders. After all, McDonald was in the house. He was alive. His family was dead. The story that he told, they felt was ridiculous. They found that Esquire magazine sitting on a coffee table. To say that Jeffrey McDonald, because there's an article about it in his house, used it as a blueprint for the murders, to me, is ridiculous. Even more ridiculous, if you like, than the fact that he said hippies broke into his house.
So, as you say, it's about building the narrative. It's about building a story. What the police and prosecutors were successful in doing was shooting down his narrative, and yet there was no material evidence and no real motive that anybody has been able to find.
No one could ever really find a motive. In fact, one of the prosecutors at trial essentially underlined that fact when said, "We don't have to give a motive. We don't have to show you that he's the kind of man who could have done it. All we have to show you is that he's the man who did do it." The physical evidence they presented at trial has never convinced me. One remarkable fact about this story is that each member of the family had a different blood type. Statistically unlikely, but true. And there was blood splattered around this apartment. I remember when I first became aware of this, it's part of the book Fatal Vision, you start to think, ooh, everybody had a different blood type. I can use that to figure out what really happened in the house that night. It'll provide a blueprint for what actually transpired. Here's the problem. No DNA testing. We don't know that the O-type blood came from anyone in particular. We just know it's O-type, or we know it's AB. And the question that I asked myself, look at the pattern of blood in the house, in the apartment. What tells you in that pattern that it was Jeffrey McDonald who produced it and not some other assailant or group of assailants? What shows you that he had to have done it? And here's the answer, nothing.
But is there anything to indicate? I mean, what would that tell you? How do you, and maybe we should take one step back here, because your background really prepares you well for this. You used to be a private investigator, so you do think in terms of how to put a case together and how to make the evidence tell a story, I guess.
I was a private investigator, and before that, I was a graduate student in history and philosophy of science. And many of these issues, one of the buzz phrases that's often used is confirmation bias, that we have a theory, and as a result of our belief in that theory, we don't look for certain kinds of evidence. We ignore it and pick evidence that supports our prior belief rather than really investigate everything. It's a story where evidence was made to look conclusive, but when you scrutinize it, when you look at it carefully, it does nothing of the sort.
Let's talk a minute or two about fatal vision, because that was the most well-known story. It was a story that came together because Jeffrey McDonald and Joe McGinnis, a journalist, developed a relationship. Joe McGinnis begins to write the story, and when it all comes out, it looks like, and he concludes, Joe McGinnis does, that Jeffrey McDonald is guilty. And, of course, you talked about Janet Malcolm's piece later on that in terms of Janet Malcolm's opinion, he really abused, McGinnis did, his authority and his position as and the relationship as a journalist. How do you feel? Did the book and then the TV series, does that have an effect on his case and subsequent appeals?
The book, the 60 Minutes episode, the TV movie were seen by over 50 million people in total. Would that affect how a case is perceived? It would be remarkable if it didn't have an effect. Part of how I describe this story is a new kind of imprisonment. Not imprisonment in some dungeon or high tower or remote island from which there can be no escape, but an imprisonment in media. Everybody thinks they know about this story. After all, they saw McDonald. Tens of millions of people saw McDonald kill his family in the TV movie. They saw the two impassioned in-laws dedicate themselves to bring Jeffrey McDonald to justice. They cast two of the nicest, most believable people in the motion picture business, Carl Malden and Eva Marie Saint. Would that have an effect on how the case is perceived? You betcha. Of course it did. And it created a prison for Jeffrey McDonald, a narrative prison from which there is perhaps no escape. I would like to believe otherwise, because I believe there is no prison, narrative or made of stone and steel, that is strong enough to exclude the truth.
Clearly you believe he didn't get a fair trial. Are you convinced that he didn't do it?
I don't believe he did it. I can't prove it. Evidence has been so lost, corrupted, misused, misplaced. I don't think it may be possible to prove that he didn't do it. There's still the possibility that DNA could turn up that would provide conclusive proof. And there is some DNA evidence that suggests that there were intruders in the house. But there's one thing I do believe. I believe he didn't get a fair trial in Raleigh. You can argue a lot of things about this case, but you really can't argue that he got a fair trial, or that the jury heard all of the evidence. We have an idea in this country, and I may be critical of the justice system, but I'm also very proud of it and proud of this country. The idea that you're innocent until proven guilty, and part of a proof of guilt is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That is just simply not true here. This trial was not fair, and Jeffrey McDonald should be released.
Well, if Jeffrey McDonald's up for parole in the year 2020, do you imagine your book will play a role, or do you plan
Wait
to play a role?
Wait a second now. He's been up for parole for quite some time now, and part of the conditions of parole is you have to essentially say, I did it, and I'm sorry, and I'll never do it again. And McDonald has refused. Remember, we're 42 years into this case. He's refused to say anything other than the fact, I didn't do it, I'm innocent, I shouldn't be here. So he can never get parole. If he would admit guilt, he could walk out of prison. He could have been out of prison already. He will never do it.
Errol Morris, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Errol Morris, Academy Award-winning filmmaker and author of A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald. And we spoke with Errol by phone last week. Since that interview, Jeffrey McDonald has appeared in U.S. District Court in an attempt to have his convictions overturned. Lawyers for McDonald presented new evidence that includes a statement from former U.S. Marshal Jimmy Britt. The statement says Helena Stokely confessed to being at the McDonald home at the night of the murders. So far, two prosecutors from the 1979 trial have testified that Helena Stokely did not confess to taking part in the murders or being in the home. Former prosecutor Jim Blackburn has also denied threatening Stokely. State of Things continues just ahead with a live performance with the Carolina Chocolate Drops. Stay with us.
I am a country girl. All day I dream about a place in the sun. Kind of like